Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Thanks. Thanks for being here. Thanks for coming. For those of you who don't know, can you hear me okay back there? For those of you who don't know, my name is Wanda. I'm a student here. I've been practicing here for, well, my granddaughter was in the second grade, and now she's going into the 10th. Now she's going into the 10th. She's finishing up the 10th. So I've been practicing here for that long. And this is my third Sunday Dharma talk. So thank you for being here. I've entitled this talk, just simply living a Zen life. And those of you who have a program, you've probably noticed that I'm not too big on words. I like the image. So it will speak to you in whatever way it wants to. We have a lot of lists in Buddhist practice, don't we?
Yes.
Those of you who have been around a long time, we have a lot of lists. We have the six paramitas: generosity, ethics, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom. We have the four divine abodes: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. We have the five precepts: doing no harm, not taking what isn't freely given, avoiding sexual misconduct, slander, and intoxication of any kind, which includes seduction. We have our four vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. I could go on all day with all the lists that we have. We also have the four mythological bodhisattvas. We have Manjushri, who is up on the mantle there on our altar. We have Avalokiteshvara. We have Samatabhadra, and we have Maitreya Bodhisattva. And these four bodhisattvas embody all the attributes and trainings that are listed in all our many, many lists. And we talk about these lists and these mythological bodhisattvas around here a lot. But recently, I came across something new. New to me. Just new to me. The four dignities from Tibetan Buddhism. Now, they contain the same teachings and practices that we do here, but they're packaged in a different way. Because the Tibetans in Tibetan Buddhism, they're big on colors, images. So the four dignities that I'm going to be talking about are the tiger, the snow lion, the Garuda, and the dragon. And they're on many of the, you'll see them a lot, on the four corners of the Tibetan prayer flag. I actually have one of those Tibetan prayer flags that I'm just going to pass around to everybody. Just that you can just kind of look at it and pass it around. I have one for back there, too. You might notice in these images how dynamic and fluid they are. There you go. Thanks. Together they represent a path, a way of being in the world. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. These four mythological creatures are boundless, and their attributes are boundless, and the path that they describe is also boundless. Can't grasp it. You can only live it. Dharma gates are boundless. So we vow to enter them. And every attribute that I'll be talking about today, and every attribute that is of these mythological creatures is also a Dharma gate. And I just chose one or two of the characteristics for each of these dignities. But remember the boundless and formless nature of each of these characteristics, and that within each one, all the others exist. Because this path that we're on extends throughout space and time. So when I say attribute, I'm referring to an opening into a specific type of awareness, which is why these attributes are boundless, because awareness is boundless. There's no edges to it when we don't contract, when we just let it be. We just let it live. We just experience it. There are no edges. So I think of these characteristics and these attributes and these virtues as awarenesses instead of behaviors that we impose on ourselves. So they're not behaviors. So I'll be talking about the various ways that we train ourselves in these awarenesses. So the first dignity is the tiger. And the tiger represents a certain composure that is naturally cultivated through through our meditation practice. It's a humble feeling. It's a humbleness, a humility. A feeling of being just at home in our own skin and in our environment. You know, in Japan, in the mountainous regions of Japan, it's often very misty. And the tiger symbol is big, not only in Tibetan Buddhism, but also in Zen. And when I think about the tiger, the image of the tiger, in my mind, I see him taking to the mountains and disappearing into the mist, vanishing into his environment. And that's the type of composure that I'll be talking about this morning. So the second one that I'll be talking about is the snow lion. She represents virtue, the awareness of virtue, the aliveness of virtue. And with the Garuda, the third dignity comes the outrageousness and unpredictability that arises from authentic insight, that arises when we let go of our fixed strategies that worked for us in the past. And then the fourth dignity is the dragon, inscrutability, Buddha nature. The fourth dignity is not something that we can strive for directly. It arises when the conditions have been cultivated. We do that through our meditation practice and through the awarenesses of the first three dignities. So the humbleness of the tiger, it comes from his willingness to accommodate himself to his environment. It's the ability to look deeply and to see the subtle nuances of our environment and of our particular situation that we're in. And also to see our own habituated reactions to our environment and to the situations that we're in. So this awareness opens us up to deep seeing, and the training is one of discernment. So when we're talking about the tiger awareness, we're talking about right here, being right here. When we accommodate ourselves to the situation, whatever it is, what we discover is that situation contains within it its own innate intelligence. his own innate possibilities for action, inherent in every situation, is this innate intelligence. But our habituated patterns blind us to that intelligence. So the tiger awareness is about seeing those habituated actions. And freeing ourselves from them. Because before we do that, it's impossible to accommodate ourselves to the environment. We're just too caught up in our own habituated patterns. There's a story about an old man who accidentally fell into the river rapids that were leading to a high and dangerous waterfall. So the onlookers feared for his life, but they were helpless to help him. Miraculously, he came out alive and unharmed downstream at the bottom of the falls. And when people asked him how he managed to survive, he said, "I accommodated myself to the water. Without even thinking, I allowed myself to be shaped by it. Plunging into the swirl, I came out with the swirl. And that's how I survived." So the waterfall itself showed him how to survive. This is the innate intelligence that's in every situation. It's not something we can understand or premeditate. It's just something we have to open up to. When the tiger is hungry, his hunger and the jungle are not separate. So the problem and the solution are not two. When we don't split off from our problems, then our problems are not problems anymore. They're just our life. When the tiger lazes in the high grass and soaks up the sun, his joy and the sun are not separate. They're not two. There's just joy. So I'm going to tell another story. I'm going to read another story about accommodating ourselves to the environment. The students in the monastery were in total awe of the elder monk, not because he was strict, but because nothing ever seemed to upset or ruffle him. So they found him a bit unearthly and even a little frightening. One day they decided to put him to the test. A bunch of them very quietly hid in a dark corner of one of the hallways and waited for the monk to walk by. Within moments, the old man appeared, carrying a cup of hot tea. Just as he passed by, the students rushed out at him, screaming as loud as they could. But the monk showed no reaction whatsoever. He peacefully made his way to a small table at the end of the hall and gently placed his cup of hot tea down on the table. And then he turned and fell against the wall and cried out in shock. That cup of hot tea he was carrying knew exactly how he should respond to that situation. So in our meditation practice, we learn how to accommodate ourselves to the situation, how to accommodate ourselves to our environment during retreats. What do? We just follow a schedule. When it's time to sit, we sit. When it's time to eat, we eat. When it's time to rest, we rest. Sounds so simple, doesn't it? And yet, for those of you who know, it takes so much effort, doesn't it? It takes so much effort. It's not the kind of effort that we're used to making. Because it's inner effort. When we eat, we just eat. And when we rest, we just rest. We make such heroic outer efforts, don't we? Every day we fall down, we get up, we lose our jobs, we lose our spouses, we pick ourselves up again and again, we find a new job, we find ways to pay for our kids' education, for their medical bills. Day after day, moment after moment, heroic effort we make. But when we can bring that same decisive, fierce effort to the cushion, interesting things start to happen. An inner steadiness starts to creep in. So the first dignity, the tiger, is about embodying this kind of effort, this inner effort that is fierce, but never aggressive, never aggressive. So the Zen teacher and author John Tarrant says that effort brings the fierceness of the outer journey to the inward. I'm going to read something that he says in this book. This is a book by John Tarrant. It's The Light Inside the Dark. It's a very good book. Here's what he has to say about habits and effort. Habits keep us unconscious, and it takes effort to break them. Effort does this with its characteristic endurance and persistence. A habit is essentially an artificial limitation that we put upon ourselves because we cannot endure the newness of each moment. The shift from habit to moment attention is described by an athlete that he knew, and he's going to tell us about him. Here's what the athlete said. The athlete said, "I used to overtrain because doing a lot made me feel like I was achieving something. It seems good to grind out the repetitions, but actually it's just lazy. It's much harder to notice just what my body needs. Notice how I'm breathing. But I do that now, and I never get injured anymore." And then John Tarrant goes on to say, "True effort is subtle. We can seem to be working hard, but in truth be lazy because we're just sweating away without asking ourselves if what we are doing is helpful or not. Such grinding is effort without integrity. True effort is harder and more interesting. It is present to every fragment of eternity passing through us." So he's talking about inner effort. He's talking about the effort that the tiger represents. In Zen, we call that great effort sometimes, our effortless effort, because it doesn't have that straining, grinding component. At the same time, it's fierce. When a cat watches, not a cell in her body is not watching. This is a great image for effortless effort. There's no strain. Every cell in the cat's body is relaxed and in a state of readiness. So this is the kind of effort that we bring to our meditation practice. And that's the kind of awareness that's embodied in the first dignity. So now I'm going to talk about the second dignity, the snow lion. The snow lion is white with a purple mane, and she lives on the mountaintops, leaping from one mountaintop to another. She is eternally vibrant, energetic, and youthful because she's not weighed down by strong emotions and self-doubt. The snow line represents virtue, which is just a manifestation of our innate basic goodness. So Buddha taught that seeing the goodness in all things is the path to freedom. He said, we can all experience the liberating taste of goodness. Just as the oceans have but one taste, the taste of salt, all my teachings have but one taste, the taste of liberation, the taste of goodness. So that was the Buddha talking about virtue and from where that virtue arises naturally. And it's our nature. Two monks were washing their bowl in the river when they noticed a scorpion that was drowning. One monk immediately scooped it up to set it on the bank. In the process, he was stung. He went back to washing his bowl, and again, the scorpion fell into the water. The monk saved the scorpion again, and again, he was stung. So the other monk asked him, friend, why do you continue to save that scorpion when you know it's its nature to sting? Because, the monk replied, to save it is my nature. Virtue. Now, we usually think of virtue as being something kind of serious and heavy. But the very image of a snow lion with his purple mane leaping from mountaintop to mountaintop challenges that way of thinking, doesn't it? So the kind of virtue that Buddha talked about, that's represented by the snow lion, is based in our basic goodness, so it's never harsh, it's never judgmental, it's never aggressive, and it's not about taking a moralistic stance. Moralistic standards separate and divide people. We tend to think less of people who don't adhere to our moral standards, don't we? So that's not the kind of virtue that is embodied in the snow lion. When I think of a human example of the snow lion, I think of the Zen poet and teacher Ryokan, who lived in the 18th and 19th century in Japan. Here's one of his poems about virtue. I forgot to thank you for that wonderful shakuhachi sound. Leo?
You're welcome.
It was great. Thanks. So here's Ryokan's poem about virtue. What was right yesterday is wrong today. How do you know what's right today wasn't wrong the day before? Right and wrong aren't something fixed. You can't tell in advance the pros and cons. The foolish are stuck on a single note, so wherever they go, they're out of tune. The wise penetrate to the source of things and pass their time roaming free and at ease. Forget about knowledge and ignorance both, and you can call yourself one who has the way. So I love the line where he says, the wise penetrate to the source of things, because he's talking about our basic goodness. So true virtue arises directly from our heart and from the heart's connection with the situation. And it doesn't always look like virtue. Tough love is the most difficult thing we can do. It's the most difficult love that we can offer. It breaks our heart, doesn't it? Those of you who are parents, it breaks our heart, doesn't it? Doesn't look like virtue, certainly doesn't feel like virtue to our kids at the time or to whoever's receiving our tough, compassionate virtue. So I want to read what the Tao Te Ching says about the discipline of virtue, because I think it's just beautiful. And this is a description of boundless virtue, virtue that arises from within us. The first verse. In the second verse, he tells the type of virtue we have to resort to when we're not in touch with our own basic goodness. So here it is. The highest virtue is to act without a sense of self. The highest kindness is to give without a condition. And the highest justice is to see without a preference. But when Tao is lost, one must learn the rules of virtue. When virtue is lost, one must learn the rules of kindness. When kindness is lost, one must learn the rules of justice. And when justice is lost, one must learn the rules of conduct. So we've all been exposed to that kind of virtue, where we have to learn the rules. But when we talk about virtue in Buddhism, we're talking about the six paramitas: generosity, ethics, patience, effort, concentration, and wisdom. And these are the attributes that the snow lion represents. Now I'm going to talk about two of them. I'm going to talk about generosity and patience. Because generosity of the snow lion is not the generosity of giving. It's the generosity of not holding on to things. The snow lion is exuberant because she's not holding on to anything. And Buddhist teachings on generosity are based on the realization that there's no separation between giver, receiver, and gift. We had a Shuso ceremony this past week where a priest... Is Martin still here? Martin had to leave. Martin was our Shuso. So at a Shuso ceremony, a priest is given a koan. And the priest allows that koan to penetrate and speak its own truth, reveal its own innate intelligence. That's how we work with koans. And then the community asks questions of the priest to find out just how that koan may have penetrated him. So we had one of those ceremonies this past week. And there's usually a verse that's associated with the koan. And I'm going to talk about one particular line in the verse. The particular line in the verse was, all throughout the universe, everything becomes food. All throughout the universe, everything becomes food. And the way Martin explained that line illustrates this teaching about giver, receiver, and gift. And what he said was, we are all nourished by everything else, and we are all nourishment to everything else. We're always giving, and we're always receiving. We can't do it any other way. Can't be any other way. So when we understand this, we just don't hold on to things. We just allow life to flow through us so that our generosity is like an open hand. Tim tells a Zen story. He's told it several times, and I really like it. It's about a monk who returned to his hut. Now, this is a hermit monk. They don't have very much to start with. But he returned to his hut to discover a thief was taking all of his things. So when the thief was caught, he turned and started to run away. But what the monk did was to yell out, "Wait, wait! You forgot these." And he took off his robe and tossed his robe to him. As he was running away, he tossed his robe to him. And then the monk sat down under a tree, and he looked up at the night sky, and there was a big, beautiful moon up there. And the monk sighed, "Ah, poor thief. I wish I could have given him the moon." Not holding on to anything. Because to hold on to anything is to hold on to the sense of self. It's to hold on to our loneliness, to our sense of separation, to our despair. So when we talk about generosity, we're talking about just letting go of all of that. So that's the generosity that's embodied in the snow lion. Now I'm going to talk about patience. We usually think of patience as being something pretty dull and boring, right? As virtues go, it's not very popular. But I'm not talking about a wait-and-see attitude here. That's not what I'm talking about. It's not the type of patience I'm talking about. The patience of the snow lion is not passive. It's actually pretty fierce. And I'm going to talk about two different aspects of patience. The first is the patience of just being here. Just being here. A martial arts student went to his student and he said earnestly, "I'm devoted to studying your martial system. How long will it take me to master it?" The teacher's reply was very casual. He said, 10 years. Impatiently, the student answers, "But I want to master it faster than that. I'll work very hard. I'll practice every day, 10 or more hours a day if I have to." "Then how long will it take?" The master thought for a minute and he said, 20 years. So patience, from a Buddhist perspective, is not a means to an end. It holds us right here on the spot. If our attention is divided, then it's going to take longer, right? So I'm talking about the patience that holds us right here on this spot, not the one that we're projecting ourselves into, where we've mastered something wonderful. To attend to this very moment requires patience. And patience is the ability to just be with our difficulties until a solution can present itself. But for most of us, solutions don't really present, do they? Because our avoidance strategies are so quick. Immediately we get caught up into what ifs and blames and feeling guilty or feeling helpless. But these are just avoidance strategies that keep taking us away from the situation. But every situation offers its own innate intelligence. But we have to penetrate the situation so we can see it, so we can open up to it. So that's the patience of just being there, just staying with it. And we practice it in our meditation over and over. We keep bringing our attention back. We catch ourselves laying on some beach in Hawaii, soaking up the sun. And we let it go and bring ourselves back. Patience, over and over. Strong emotions arise during our meditation, and we just be with them. We let them arise without blaming or getting caught up in the stories that we attach to them, which are just avoidance strategies. We just feel our emotions move through our body. We feel the sensation fully, fully. We allow it a full, whole life. We experience their intensity, and then we experience them dissolve, which they always do once they've been experienced. And each one of our emotions bring their own innate intelligence. When we experience them deeply, when they dissolve, they leave something behind. We feel stronger. We feel more stable. Less fearful. So that's the innate intelligence that our emotions have to offer, if we have the courage and the patience to allow them to manifest, to live out their lives, so to speak, and then to move on out into the cosmos, leaving something behind. Pema Chodron said, "Being on the spot, even when it hurts, is preferable to avoiding." So the other aspect of patience that I want to talk about, Snowline's patience, is waiting. Waiting. Not wait and see. Not that kind of waiting. Not waiting for a bus. Not that kind of waiting. Not waiting for the bell to ring. John Tarrant talks about another kind of waiting. He talks about the kind of waiting that shifts us into the realm of the sacred. So when we enter the Zendo, not on Sundays, we're pretty casual on Sundays, but usually when we enter the Zendo to sit meditation, we pause at the door just for a moment at the entryway. And in that pause, in that moment of waiting, there's an inner shift that happens, an inner shift toward the sacred, toward the mystery, toward the stillness happens. The mind starts to settle down. When a person arrives at a traditional Japanese monastery, they're refused entry at first. They have to wait. They have to wait outside. Sometimes they have to wait for hours. Sometimes they have to wait for days. They just sit outside in Zazen, in a meditation posture, hour after hour, and they wait. Now, sometimes a monk will come out and run them off. But this is a kind and compassionate gesture. This is giving them a chance to get up, to leave, to relax, to rest, and then come back and wait some more. Eventually, the abbot will let them in if they endure the waiting. The abbot will let them in. And when he does, they have changed. An inner sacredness has settled in just through the waiting, just through their willingness to wait. All their excitement and enthusiasm and the ambition that they arrived with has vanished. So when they enter the monastery, they're of the same mind as the monks who live and practice there. John Tarrant says that waiting has its own elegance and disciplines. I want to read something that he says, because he puts it so beautifully. We wait so that we can catch up with ourselves, so that the rhythm can take shape before we start to dance. We wait because we can imagine far ahead of our ability to embody. And then he tells a story about waiting, a Jesus story about waiting, and I'm going to read it. There was a moment when Jesus shows his mastery of such timing, of such waiting. In the story, a crowd has caught a woman sleeping with a man, not her husband. They are angry and want to stone her to death. It's not clear why they asked Jesus to speak. Perhaps they want his blessing on the murder. Perhaps there's some unconscious doubt in them. Jesus does intervene, but not straight away. Preaching to an angry mob is a ticklish business. At first, he distracts. He draws on the ground with a stick. We're not told what he draws. It's the action itself that's important. This is an inventive gesture. It offers no answer, yet keeps the question in suspension. The crowd becomes unsure whether this is his response or not. A gap opens in their certainty. Time passes, and the moment becomes less fixed. Then when Jesus speaks, the reproof in his words is indirect and points to the quest of knowledge. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. The men in the crowd are turned inwards, and so they walk away, each to his own destiny. Like other good solutions in a desperate situation, this one came from nowhere, unpremeditated, given by grace. So that, again, is about finding the innate intelligence in every situation. It's about having the awareness of the tiger, deep seeing, and then the virtue of the snow lion, waiting. So the last thing I want to say about patience is about our founder, Dainen Katagiri, whose name actually means great patience. I want to read a paragraph from his bio written by Andrea Martin, with your permission. Dainen is not the name that Katagiri Roshi was born with, nor one that he initially embraced. It is his Dharma name, given to him by his master at ordination. He wanted to keep his childhood name, Yoshiyuki, because it meant good luck. He liked it very much, so he kept using it. But when his master reminded him one day that he should use his new name, Great Patience, finally, he accepted it and became Dainen Katagiri. Still, as a young Buddhist priest, he didn't like his name, because he understood patience in the usual way. And patience was not something that he valued. Later, as his life unfolded, he grew to understand the deeper meaning of the name and came to appreciate it. So the patience that Katagiri Roshi came to appreciate was the patience of the snow lion. And now the third dignity. Holy cow. The Garuda. Running out of time, that was the holy cow. Okay, the first two dignities are symbolized by the earthbound animals. The tiger is very rooted in his environment. The snow lion leaps from mountaintop to mountaintop, but still she's earthbound. But the awareness of the Garuda and the dragon is expanded awareness, leaving the earth altogether. The very act of visualizing the Garuda challenges our ideas about who we are and the way things should be. He has large red feathered wingspread. He has a human torso and arms. He has the face of a bird with a large sharp beak. So that's the Garuda. He was born in outer space, and he's flying from the moment of birth. He never lands, so he is completely groundless. And from his bird's eye view, everyone looks exactly the same. So groundlessness and equanimity are his natural characteristics. Groundlessness refers to the capacity to just be. Just be, without holding on to any ideas, without holding on to any concepts about ourselves and about other. I love what Norman Fisher said about no self in the Shambhala Sun. He said, "There's no such thing as a person. No such thing as a person. There are only persons who have co-created one another over the long history of our species." And in his paragraph, he writes, in his article, he writes, "Literally every thought in our minds, every emotion that we feel, every word that comes out of our mouth, every material sustenance that we need to get through the day comes through the kindness and the interaction of others. And not only other people, but non-humans too. Literally the whole earth, the soil, the trees, the air we breathe, the water we drink. We don't just depend on all this. We are all of this, and it is us." Non-self. And the Garuda, with the Garuda, we come to our biggest challenge yet, freeing ourselves from the constant driving force of hope and fear. In Western culture, hope is something positive. But in Buddhism, not so much. Because hope and fear are not separate entities. They are one. And anytime you feel hope, you also feel fear. You hope for one thing, you fear it won't come to pass. And anytime you feel fear, you feel hope. And hope and fear constantly takes us out of the moment. So the Garuda doesn't engage in hope or fear because he's fully engaged in the moment. He's not trying to escape by wishing that things were different, wishing that things were more exciting or less painful. So I'm trying to decide how much of this I'm going to actually get to and what I should skip. So when the solution, when we can let go of our hope and fear and just engage with the situation, whatever it is, just be open to it, the solution that arises comes from the innate intelligence of the situation. And the outcome is always surprising. So that's why the natural characteristic of the Garuda is unpredictability and outrageousness. We can never predict. So the story about the Buddha throwing his begging bowl into the river and it skips upstream is kind of the story about the path of the Garuda. It always goes against cultural norms. So now I'm going to talk for just a few minutes about the dragon. The inscrutable, inconceivable dragon. Because while the Garuda is born fully developed and flying from the moment of birth, the dragon is timeless. The dragon is beyond life and death. Suzuki Roshi used to tell a story. He said that in ancient China, there was a person who liked dragons very much. He talked about dragons to his friends all the time. He painted dragons. He had statues of dragons everywhere. Then a dragon said to himself, if a real dragon like me visited this man who loves dragons so much, he would be very happy. So one day the real dragon sneaked into the man's room and said hello. The man didn't know what to do. He froze. He couldn't run. He couldn't even stand up. And Suzuki Roshi finishes his story by saying, for a long, long time, we have been like him. That should not be our attitude. We should not just be a fan of dragons. We should always be the dragon himself. So the fourth dignity of the dragon represents the nature of reality. Represents Buddha nature. And the dragon symbolizes a connection, an intimacy with our true nature. From a Zen point of view, when we're intimate with anything, there's no separation. And I'm going to finish with a story that I heard just recently that is about this intimacy that I'm talking about. This is a beautiful story that was told to me by a member of the Sangha who gave me permission to share this story with you. A while back, she adopted a horse. And being an animal person, she really wanted to connect to this horse. It was an adult horse. But she really wanted to develop a connection with it, heart to heart. So she spent a lot of time with it, exercising it, walking him, brushing him, talking to him, reaching out to him. But that connection just wasn't happening. The horse just wasn't going there with her. Then something happened in her own life, a crisis in her own life, and she was completely distraught, just trying to make it through the day. But when the time came to take care of the horse, she went to the stable. She took the horse out. She didn't ride him that day. She just walked him around the arena. She didn't talk to him. She didn't brush him. She didn't try to connect with him. She didn't try to get him to like her or to accept her. She just walked, holding the rein, round and around the arena. Until, quite suddenly, a wave of despair just overtook her, so strong. It hit her so hard that she just dropped to the ground. And she sat there and she sobbed, holding the rein. She just sat there and sobbed. Suddenly, the horse, who had always been so indifferent to all of her efforts, came over to her and lowered his big head and pressed his forehead right against her heart. Pressed his forehead right here. And just held her in that way. Intimacy. We don't know what it is, but we know it when we've experienced it. When the dragon swallows the entire universe, mountain, rivers, and the great earth are nowhere to be found. No separation, no way to grasp it. I didn't have to experience that horse's head pressing against my own chest to be nourished by it. I'm nourished every time I think of it. It's like Dogen's painting of a rice cake, huh? We don't have to understand it. We can't anyway. So the fourth dignity, the dragon, represents the inconceivable. And it's always present. It's always offering its own innate intelligence, speaking directly to our hearts. The birds sing of it. The chattering brook against the stones speak of it. A horse pressing against a human heart manifests it. It's only our grasping that keeps us from experiencing it. So, that's the fourth dignity. That's the dragon. Intimacy with the unknown. So, living a Zen life is about... it's about seeing the innate intelligence of every situation. About just allowing it to open up within us, reveal itself, to open our hearts, and to free our minds. And I'm sorry, I didn't stop in time to have questions.